Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Telegraph Rugby Podcast. You're joined as ever by myself, Ben Coles, and I'm here with Charlie Morgan. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning, Colesy.
And by Charles Richardson. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Colesy.
Charles, you've got a lovely backdrop behind you. Where in the world are you?
I am currently in Rose after the match yesterday. I bring you Roman sunshine. I'm currently sitting 500 metres from the Stadio Flaminio, their former stadium. And I think I've just got a double espresso just on its way.
That sounds fantastic, to be honest. So, Charles, you were in Rome and you were at Twickenham. Charlie, you managed to roll out of bed to pop over to Twickenham down the road, which is very good.
Yeah.
And I was at home on the sofa with a beer, praying that my newborn son would continue to sleep throughout both matches, which I'm delighted to say he did on Saturday. So that was a real win.
Which we disgustingly didn't acknowledge last week. Massive congratulations to new dad Ben Coles.
Oh, you're too
10 days
kind.
In.
You're too kind. He'll be covering Sale against Newcastle on the Friday night before we know it. There is lots to discuss after that opening weekend of the Six Nations. So let's get cracking. Three Six Nations matches and three away wins. I think I read for the first time ever on the opening weekend, which is quite a fact, actually. Can you just give me a quick highlight from the weekend before we dive more into the games? John, starting with you, what was your highlight?
I'm going to go with Gregor Townsend's answer to a question in a presser about Duane van der Merwe's first try, the mad kick return where he beat five players, maybe even six. But Gregor Townsend got asked about it, beamed, just a huge, huge, lovely grin. And he said, wasn't it just like watching Jonah Lomu rugby on the PlayStation? And you think there's so much needle in these games. There's so much kind of, so many hot takes afterwards, so much kind of anger when losing sides. But just Greg Townsend's answer there just exuded just real innocence, which I just absolutely, absolutely loved. I burst out laughing kind of just mainly at his demeanor, but it was just lovely.
When we do the rugby gaming podcast at some point in the future, we'll have to remember that. Charles, about you? What was your favourite highlight?
It was an easy one, actually. There was a first half Italian attack in Rome in that narrow loss to France yesterday, in that brave loss to France yesterday. The Canone brothers in full flow, the sort of the best famous play fluidity I've ever seen from an Italian team. They've always relied on individual brilliance or pretty forwards. But yesterday, they had cohesion, they had organisation, and then they had that silk on top. They all seemed to be singing off the same song sheet, and they really caused France problems. I still maintain I don't think France were that poor, and Italy were excellent.
Yeah, they were. They certainly were. I think for me, probably two quick ones. Firstly, might have been Telegraph columnist Sarim McGeeken's coat on ITV, which I was just not ready for, and was absolutely fantastic. I think it might have been Ugo Magnani who said that is definitely a Christmas present, which is belatedly being put to good use, and it just happened to be on national TV.
Action Gage.
Action Gage. And he wasn't alone because Princess Anne in the stands during the first half was wearing some really impressive sort of visor sunglasses, they look like, which is, as a couple of people said to me, looked as though she should have been fielding first or second slip, which I really enjoyed. She really did look the part. And just a quick on through one, it's probably Angie Capuano's finish against France, the little stop and go, just rooted Gregory Aldrich for half a second and allowed him to dive over into the corner. Maybe because it's underlined to me that he's not a sort of a one-off fluke after that draw against Wales last year. Like, he really is quite special. So those that we enjoyed over the weekend, but I think we should start thinking about England and sort of moving into that discussion. So let's focus a bit more on another famous Scottish winner, Twickenham in the Calcutta Cup. Right, guys, you were both in Twickenham. It's the start of a new era for Steve Borthwick, but it's a similar result against Scotland to the ones that Eddie Jones was suffering at the end of his time in charge. Charlie, if I just start with you, where is the main area where Scotland sort of won this game? And I guess also where England lost it.
Oh, wow. So many. So one big cliche is that you've got to win a test match more than once. We hear that quite a lot from players who've been around the block. And you've got to stick in and make sure that in that last quarter, even in the last 10 minutes, 5 minutes, that you make right decisions and you kind of get yourself over the line because you've stuck in the fight that long. This game totally epitomised that. Scotland went ahead to look far kind of more potent, just look more incisive because of maybe that uncertainty in England's defence. Whether that's, I imagine we'll touch on England's 10-12 axis at some point on this podcast, but maybe that was partly to do with that. They managed to get in those ins. They certainly, Charles turned to me at the time and Scotland went over the top from the first few lineouts, clearly trying to access that midfield and get a bit of impetus through there. I thought Scotland defended brilliantly, even though, because they had to do that because England put together some neat phase play. But they stuck in the fight, and what ultimately won them the game, this is a serious long answer to that question, is the fact that they had conviction in their attack, and eventually they stuck in the kicking exchanges for maybe the first hour, and then noticeably in the last 20 minutes it was still close. They backed themselves to go from deep a little bit more. Ben Russell had been disrupted a few times in the game. He'd made a few mistakes. One thing he does is he never tightens up. It was him from Ben Young's clearance that went too long, was fielded by Russell. Russell spins out, feeds back Kinghorn, another pass to Sione Tuitupolotu, allows Scotland to make it up to the 10-meter line. They've got impetus. They can bounce back to the touchline. They can go from coast to coast. That's what wins it ultimately. A really nice skills from Richie Gray, Fraser Brown, Matt Ferguson, putting Duane van der Merwe for his second contrasting one to try. But yeah, that conviction to back their skills, I think, eventually won Scotland.
That's as good a pass in the second row as you'll see as well from Richie Gray. As good a pass to Duane van der Merwe for that match-winning try. I know Fraser Brown's was excellent, but Richie Gray's just took so much more poise, so much more peripheral sort of awareness of his peripheries, the vision, the execution, the sort of decision-making that all would have gone through his brain there from the second row in the, whatever it was, 74th, 75th minute after slogging it out against a beaten but fired up England pack was stunning.
It's not the worst defensive read from Max Maynans on the edge either. He imparts a little bit of pressure. It has to be excellent from Gray. It really is. But that's summed up. It's now one in. So they've won four of the last six against England. It's one in six wins for England. Calcutta Cup. In each one of those games, there's a common thread of them just being a little bit more street smart, a little bit more skillful. And that's what's won out in invariably tight games. Another tight game. And we can talk about whether England's defensive lapses were really glaring. And you wonder whether that's almost more encouraging because you would hope that really glaring lapses like Ben Curry's missed tackle on Ben White and Farrell chasing after Finn Russell before the first try, they'd be eradicated fairly easily.
But actually, overall, you know, Scotland has shown the grit to stay in games, and just the skill and the streetwise kind of nature of them as a team, really cohesive as well. They're building something, and across the weekend, we just saw the value of when a team has been together for quite a while. You know, England and Wales are the ones that are playing catch up in that regard, and that maybe showed.
Just on the back of that point about tying together and sort of how Scotland have built this gradually over a few years. The last sort of play in the corner where England went for the to essentially get driving more and try and drive it for a winning try, and how well Scotland defended that felt incredibly symbolic. It's sort of where England are in terms of trying to regain this sense of purpose for their set piece work up front, and brought through, as we know, is going to really pride himself on that, just get what he did the best. But the fact that England's more, it really just splattered in that situation, how well Scotland sort of shut it down. I thought it was a really telling moment, because it showed how much further England have to go in that area. Actually, maybe sort of revealed just actually the extent of this rebuild and how much work there is to do.
Yeah, I think with Steve Borthwick in charge, one thing, you know, we will expect is to have that variation, that effectiveness with them all, and not just that, how that, you know, what options they can run off back, going peeling away from drives and playing into midfield. The Ellis Genge's try was a real illustration of how variation can manipulate defensives, and we've got a piece on that and on the website. They win a scrum penalty, they go to touch, they maul, they get a penalty because Richard Gray comes in the side and tries to stop it immediately. Then they go to the corner again, and they look to maul, suck in Scotland. Ben Curry plays away to Alex Dombrap, massive gain line, and it's going to score. They had one way to go in that last line out that you mentioned there, Colsey. They were always going to maul, and Scotland have just looked at it back. Hopefully have a piece online on Scotland's performance in a bit more detail later. But they hit that maul straight away. The Gray brothers, Jamie Ritchie, and that's what stops England getting that momentum, so they have to go to their phase play. And then I think the last penalty is 50-50. It's Richie Gray and I think Dempsey, I might be wrong. They're on the wrong side, they're blocking clearers. But Jamie Ritchie is clearly overballs. 50-50, doesn't go England's way, but you earn your luck, and Scotland did that throughout the rest of the 80s.
We had a question from a colleague down in Australia, Christy Doran, just about Borthwick, which I thought we put out there first. And he said, why are people more optimistic about Borthwick and willing to listen to him say that England were in a bad place in the autumn when Jones won a Grand Slam in his first Six Nations as England head coach? Charlie, what do you make of that?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? And he wanted to add the stat that four tries conceded was the same as England did throughout that 2016 tournament, which is quite stark. I would say, so there's two things here. One thing is the relative times that they've taken over. So taking over 1 year from a World Cup is probably a little bit different when other sides are sort of building impetus towards that tournament. Eddie Jones was at the beginning of a new cycle, and he carried over a lot of those players in England, and Stuart Lancaster, as everybody I think would acknowledge, had that squad in a good place, even though their performances in 2015 weren't good enough. Borthwick is picking up the pieces from a really disjointed World Cup cycle, and is trying to kind of get England back on track, whereas other sides, certainly Ireland, certainly France, certainly Scotland, certainly Italy, have got that momentum. They're building really nicely. They look really cohesive. They look really as though they've got a style of play that suits them, and they're working with that really well. And then the other thing is, really easy to get how close some of those games were in 2016. They scraped through at Murrayfield, didn't they? It's Jack Noll try from a really nice Maka Vinopola circle ball, gets them over the line there. Grand Slam game, really, really tight against Ireland. They're pretty convincing, I want to say, in the other games. And then Akanis again was a really tight one. It's difficult, but I think that first point was really interesting, and Steve Borthwick's come out. He gave a pretty punchy media session, very matter of fact as he always is, but just saying, look, there's so many facets of this team that are behind the eight. It's going to be me having to pick up the pieces there, and there are a lot of moving parts we've got to get right. And I think that's fair to say. But yeah, that's And there's also, and Christy made this point to me, was that it looks like England have focused on their attack kind of primarily, or they think they can get some gains there having brought in Nick Evans, and they did put together some nice base play. The defensive lapses, though, as they tried to bed in Kevin Sinfield's system, cost up.
We're just going to hear some audio from Steve Borthwick, just reflecting on that, on the game. And then, Charles, I want to come to you just to get an idea of what it was like post-match in terms of the mood among the players and the coaches. So let's hear from Steve Borthwick now.
Been right frank from day one. There is a lot of work to do. I don't see, when I looked at the team from the autumn and measured the team, got all the data from the team, we weren't good in anything. So that was as frank as that. So we're trying to build some strengths in this team. There's some bits we're pleased about, some bits we're disappointed today. Now, our job is to make sure that we get improvement for next week. Well, you've got to be hard to score against. Now, that's fundamental. You've got to be hard to beat. We gave them, they scored. And you can say, credit to them. They took their chances really well. But we will improve. We will be better with Aaron. They won't get those opportunities, and we'll also shut them down if they did. But I think there was, fundamentally, there was other chances we gave them where we relieved pressure, and we shouldn't be relieving pressure on opposition the way we did it.
Charles, what was it? What was he sort of like post-match? What were the players like? What was the general vibe?
I'm not quite as disappointed and as negative as I was expecting, actually. I think we both said this, Charlie, after the game, didn't we? There was obviously a lot of disappointment hanging over them because they lost at home to Scotland in the opening game with after a really sort of optimistic, feel-good week. I think they were all brutally honest in that was a game that they could have won. Maybe a game that on another day they should have won, really. And I think that they were encouraged by certain aspects of it, and that they showed enough whereby moving forward there is real hope for perhaps not the rest of the Six Nations. Maybe that's too soon to expect a drastic improvements, but certainly beyond. You know, there's a World Cup at the end of the year. And I think there was enough in parts to show that, you know, that the Borthwick has them going in the right direction. They just never get up against a much more established team. They stuck in the fight for 65 minutes and then exploded through Finn Russell and through a really cohesive midfield and three-quarter selection who took their chances beautifully.
Is there a more general point to be made here that the team that Borthwick put out on Saturday was obviously not the ideal side that he might have had in mind, I don't know, at the start of January? Because if you think about it, it wasn't available. You didn't have Dan Kelly, you didn't have Henry Slade, and for my money, they would probably have been the starting partnership in midfield, just given how well Slade had been playing in the autumn and how well Kelly had been playing. And then also Courtney Laws in the pack as well. Do we think because of that, and Charlie, I'll come to you with this first, do we sort of need a bit more perspective there about what England produced, given that this wasn't really the team that the Borthwick might have had in mind?
Yeah, just to go back to 2016, they didn't go to Cardiff. They had Wales at Twickenham, but won 25-21, took a couple of late tries for Wales, and they hung on. That they misremembered that, but yeah, some of those games were close, was the point I was making. Go back to the question, absolutely. I think everything was set up initially to have Farrell at 10 with Kelly at 12, and to have a look at that partnership with the second ball player being either one of or both of Henry Slade and Elliot Daly. All three of those guys were injured within either in the last week of European action or in camp. In Kelly's case, or it might be before, we're not sure on that, and we're still awaiting confirmation of how serious his thigh injury is. But our suspicion is that he might miss the entire tournament, if not certainly the Italy game, which is a shame because that solidity, I think, at 12 is what they really fancied. And Kelly, knowing one of the kind of things that Steve Borthwick kind of mentioned, that bedding into Sinfield's system was a reason for those defensive errors. And I think with Kelly there, you'd have maybe had that cohesion. It was Ian on Twitter that mentioned that Kelly's absence was potentially a bigger setback than we might have thought at the time. I think I agree with him. Although there are flashes, there were flashes from, as we keep saying, that phase play was decent, and I think England certainly set up to play a certain way, certainly played to stick in the kicking exchanges, and they did enough, as Charles mentioned there, did enough. And it's so difficult judging and making these big sweeping judgments on the back of one-off test matches, especially when, not only are the margins so tight, not only is the landscape of test rugby so close, and you know, they swing on the smallest moments, but also that 2 week build up to a game that the Six Nations had. You're making these judgments on really, really, really small margins.
And that's the game.
And that's the game, yeah. And I agree with you, just to butt in there, I agree with you, Colsey. I think Steve Borthwick would have hung his hat on Farrell at 10, Kelly at 12, Slade at 13. And I think once it became clear that Kelly was injured, he was sort of looking around going, right, who's the 12? And once he decided that wasn't going to be Manu Tuilagi, I think for just consistency and perhaps for just to try and keep some cohesion, he went with Smith and Farrell. But I think long term he has to be looking at Farrell at 10 and Smith off the bench. As we remarked on Saturday, and as many people have pointed out, most of England's best attacking moments came with Farrell stepping the first receiver.
Mentioning Mark Smith, there's a bit of audio from him afterwards in the mix zone. Let's sort of hear what he had to say about sort of how the game went and his sort of partnership with Owen Farrell, which I think everybody is still waiting to truly flourish. Let's hear from Smith now.
I've learned a lot the last couple of years playing for England, and I'm only early in my career, so I'll keep learning. It's a massive step up from club rugby, so I'll learn as fast as I can, and hopefully keep improving as a player. I'm still young.
As far as the flow you were getting, maybe in the lead up to Max's second, is that the best you felt it?
Yeah, as I said, I felt good out there. I wasn't thinking. I was in the game. The plan was so drilled into us and so practiced that I wasn't thinking out there, and I felt good, and I think we felt good as a team, but it was just a couple of moments. We need to keep our foot on the gas and put that team away.
He's in quite an interesting place, isn't he, at the moment? Do we think that with Italy coming to Twickenham and with Kelly seemingly out, they will stick with this partnership and give it another go? Charlie, I'll come to you there.
Jeez, I've gone round in my head about this. I think yes. I think that is. I think that's what I'm going to settle on. I think they stick with it. I think maybe they go with Lawrence rather than Marchant at 13 and Jack Willis at 7, and that just gives them a little bit more oomph in those areas that Charles is talking about. Because at the minute, as Charles says, it just seems like too much has to go right for England to gain momentum. It's too tricky. If that makes sense. That's a really kind of flimsy way of explaining it. But it just seems like there's too many moving parts for it to come good consistently. And they just need that little bit of penetration, a little bit more added penetration. Ellis Genge making, as Charles quite rightly made the point, Ellis Genge made 18 carries at the weekend. That's just so much for your Lucep prop to be the keynote focal point. Of a carrier having to come around the corner from line out is a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Is it fair to say that's unsustainable? They had sort of at least a prop making.
I don't know.
Carries at retest.
I remember somebody put it to him, or he volunteered an answer to it when Eddie Jones was trying to put him in the backfield, as he would have done Billy Vilipola against Scotland last year. He said, "Oh well, I saw Ellis Genge. This is said. Oh well, somebody." I saw somebody say that I might have been too tired for scrummaging. I didn't feel like that at all.
Yeah.
He's going to say that obviously, but you know, he will be willing to take on any extra added responsibility that the team will bestow on him, because he's that sort of guy. I think it's been a good choice to make him vice captain and keep him as a prominent leader with the group, but that's just such a lot to be putting on him. I wonder. So I think with Kelly out, I think with Daly definitely out, we wonder what's the alternative. Is it Slade and Marchant, as if you're going to go one of either Smith or Farrell?
or does he bring Manu back? We know that he's not got the ball-carrying prowess of old, but is his threat and his direction still greater than the alternatives?
It said a lot about Tulani, I think, and what both in Mexico, and that instead of that they sort of reverted back to Smith and Farrell partnership as opposed to just trying Tulani in the 12 shirt with March and Farrell at 10 and trying to give Farrell more time at 10. I think the fact that it changes his so much sort of shows the kind of standing that Tulani has at the moment. And I just, before we finish this section, I want to go back to Scotland because I just want to give, I want to throw a few more flowers going back to Mervis Way after his tries. It's the first try the two of you have seen, been two tries it took him. Is it in your top three tries you've seen it took him, or tries you think of ever in school it took him? And if not, I'll give you an out. If not, is it just because the tackling was not very great? Charlie, you start.
I kind of think it's like when tries get, I hate it when social media clips get put up and the first comment is, well, the fence there is crap, and you're going, look at the athleticism on the running, come on, celebrate. His second, as far as a team move, was amazing as well, and actually I thought Max Malin's second was just almost shocked everybody because of the efficiency and sharpness of it as well.
Yeah, I'd have it in my top three, I'd agree. It was a sensational thing to watch, and I think what made it more sort of sensational was that England have just changed defence coach to this defensive guru who is, you know, proven with Leicester, Kevin Sinfield, who the players seemingly adore and have massively got on board with and seems to inspire and motivate these players around him. And in terms of defensive system, it might take a while to put in, but I don't think we were expecting Scotland to sort of cut through England. Easily is probably the wrong word, but you know, so sort of comfortably really with one player. And when he scored that was surprising and that was shocking. It made you stand up and think, wow, I think that was just genuinely something special.
I wanted to reel off a few more Scotland heroes. Ben White was fantastic. I think Gregor Townsend really deserves credit for that selection. He's rewarded domestic form there because White's been brilliant for London Irish. He was always plays with this chip on his shoulder. He's a real competitor. Premiership debut at 17 for Leicester. I was going back in the Telegraph annals, interviewed him in 2017, just one of the most unfussy guys. I don't know whether he still is, but at the time he was the youngest ever Premiership debutant for Leicester in history, beating Ford and Youngs. And he spoke about what it meant and just couldn't have been less elaborate about it. But he was excellent for Irish against Saracens in that wing. Greg Townsend picking that All Glasgow centre partnership paid off as well. We were, you know, really ballsy to leave Chris Harris on the bench. And Carl Steyn, I think it's Cameron Fisher, has tweeted to say that he was quietly brilliant, which I think is right. He caused a lot of trouble from those restarts, which was a big area of big issue for England. And we might have had another phenomenal try about 15 minutes before the decisive one, Tuukka-Lotta just failing to, or was it, sorry, Steyn failing to put in Stuart Hogg's pass from another kick return, which is sort of when Scotland started to turn the screw and get a little bit more ambitious to win the game. So just deserve all the credit.
Kyle Steyn, who I saw Graham Love point out on Twitter, was marked down with a try assist for the Dylan Bender Merton first try.
Yeah,
even though he gave him the pass, what, inside Scotland's head? All about the Murphy run.
Amazing.
With Ben White, I did a bit of digging and I forgot that at one point Leicester had Ben Young, Richard Wigglesworth, Ben White and Jack Van Portley in the academy all at the same time, which is a pretty gun scrum half group, to be fair. Also saw Tuan Vandermeer in the petrol station in Worcester last November and thought, no cheers, I would not want to tackle you. He is so I can't really criticize England's players too much, but other than, you know, paid professionals. Phenomenal getting down. And just very finally on this game, before we look ahead to Italy, just a quick mention for Scott Hastings. Amazing reaction to the second try. If you get a chance to watch the highlights back and hear it, it's brilliant. It's sort of on a par. It's a noise just from the soul, really. It's sort of on a par with Gary Neville's interesting noise when Fernando Torres scored against Barcelona in the Champions League about a decade ago, which I know was known as the goalgasm afterwards. And let's just say that Scott Hastings produced the trigasm, and leave that section there on a high note. As we look ahead to Italy coming to Twickenham this weekend, after their performance on Sunday, it seems a lot more interesting. Okay, Ned, so let's talk a bit about Italy. Charles, you're having a lovely, lovely time in Rome, by the looks of things. I saw you sipping on a double espresso just now. What did you enjoy most about Italy yesterday? And I just want to tack a question onto the end of that, which we had from Alfie and from Reese, which is, could Italy win two matches in this Six Nations? I mean, it's not impossible.
Two whole is maybe a stretch, but two, certainly. Wales have got to go to Rome, and that is going to be a very, very tasty. I mean, England have to get by Italy on Sunday, and with what we saw yesterday, that these guys are no slouches. Kieran Crowley has overseen a remarkable resurgence and improvement there. The front row stood up, and podcast favourite Danilo Fischetti was incredible again, surrendering, I reckon, 20 to 30 kilos on Weenie Antonio, his opposite number, and he stood up in the scrum. You know, they had, France had Weenie Antonio at tight head with Paul Willemse, the South African beast behind him, and Fischetti, sorry, the South African board beast, sorry, they're playing for France, behind him. And Fischetti really held his own with a light lock on his loose end side. The two locks, the Canoni brothers as well, with number eight, were superb. Negri, Lamaro, as ever, just fought their socks off and stood up to a man against a world-class pack. France, maybe alongside Ireland, the most rounded, the best balanced pack in world rugby. And it's only matched them in they found two centres who sort of like Scotland at international level, perhaps don't do as much of the flashy stuff, but they did a lot of the detail, sort of glue that held it all together, a bit like Anne Kelly with England, really. I thought they were excellent, and then they've got guys like Menoncello and Capuozzo behind, who real cutting edge. And England need to have the wits about them next week. And the worrying thing for Steve Borthwick and the worrying thing for England is that where Italy looked strong yesterday, sort of where in a similar areas to where England were found wanting against Scotland.
I don't think England will concede as many. It was 18 penalties, wasn't it? Which is more than France have ever conceded in a Six Nations game. Mackie Carley refereeing, Premiership, we know Premiership referees like that breakdown to be clean. And where France have kind of, they built their success on, is going really hard at that breakdown and maybe getting kind of talked away. Jackal is getting talked away quite a lot. We always talk about Gregory Aldrete being an absolute pest, but actually being able to react to what he's being told sort of in the midst of those rucks. And I think, I just don't think France got given that choice a lot by Carly, but he was very quick and kind of stern on that area of the game. I don't think England will concede that many penalties at the ruck because they'll be able to react a little bit better. However, I do think if Italy are within a score and the hour mark, we know this England side at the minute looks a little bit neurotic. What I love about this Italy side, they've really got that they're tenacious up front, and they've got those really kind of industrious, love Michele Lamaro, and the pack is sort of built in his image, as it were, as captain. But that flowing phase play with Capuozzo kind of hitting the line as part of those kind of stacked playmakers, and Tommy Allen, that's sort of how Quinn's playing, so he's obviously pretty comfortable with that, and Garbisi's absent. If they get some of that, if our listeners haven't watched the highlights of Italy's eventual win over Australia and some of those tries, just how that lateral movement of their backs and like swinging late around those breakdowns into position, it's just fantastic. And I think challenging England laterally will be what they aim to do.
And just on that French indiscipline, a cracking stat. Charles Olivon's yellow card yesterday was their first sin-bin since Julien Marchal against Argentina in the 2021 Autumn Internationals. That's their first yellow card at international level, which is a staggering stat, really, considering the increase in the number of cards we've seen on the international rugby landscape. And that comes from Sean Edwards instilling a real disciplined edge to this French team. I mean, you could see him on the coverage yesterday. He was very, very unhappy, very, very vexed and perplexed. And he would have been tearing his hair out.
Would he?
Sorry, let's go. Let's go. Let's move on swiftly. Let's move on swiftly. Let's move on swiftly about that. He would have been tearing his hair out if he had any. Yeah, I'll say it. Fine. He would have been tearing his hair out. He'd have been tearing his metaphorical hair out yesterday. And he was afterwards. He was unhappy. And they've got 5 days to put it right before they play the best team in the world, and they will have to put it right. And to be honest, if you were to back anybody who would put it right, it probably would be Sean Edwards.
Perplexed is bang on. It's saying I've never had a defence who'd been penalised like that. I do think it's partly maybe referees being a little bit more stringent on what France have been excellent at, and we've had this I think it's a positive thing overall for referees to be really stringent on that jackler, because there's just nothing worse than an illegal jackler being talked away from the ball after they've already influenced the speed of the ruck. But if we know Sean Edwards, we'll know that his team will adapt very, very quickly.
But I just wondered, deep down, Edwards and Gauthier are actually delighted to have had that game now at the start of this year, just so the side can sort of process being pretty shocking in the breakdown and not adapting, and sort of have and learn from that in time for bigger fish to fry next week in Dublin, and but more importantly at the Rugby World Cup as well. I think in terms of long-term development, it's probably quite a good feat to have that test. Just one more thing, and it's the Charles, I had a tweet from Adam Shaw who said, do you reckon if Garbisi starts yesterday that Italy win that game? If they'd had Paddle Garbisi starting at 10, they'd have him in the minutes. Do you reckon they see it out? I'm tempted to say maybe.
I'm tempted to say yes. I mean, I wrote in my report that I thought that I think Tommy Allen is a fantastic understudy to Marcus Smith at Harlequins, and Stephen Varney is a perfectly respectable club scrum half. But Italy needs some direction and some more authority at halfback and some greater skill. And I think if Garbisi was at 10 and they had an improved scrum half, they would have won yesterday. Yes, I'd happily stick my neck out and say that.
Do we hope that there's some sort of Alessandro Tromcon regen somewhere in Italy who's about to sort of come in? Oh, no, it's Garbisi's brother as well.
Garbisi's brother. Yeah, we've got Garbisi 102 at halfback for Italy, which would be phenomenal if the scrum half version of Garbisi can live up to his white half brother. That would be quite something, and would, I think, genuinely make people stand up and take note of Italy on the world stage.
The Garbisi bros, I can see the Mario Luigi memes already, and they're excellent. With Italy being so competitive, which I've got to say, it is really fantastic. I tweeted out yesterday, I don't really need Italy to win this. I just want them to be good. I want to go into Italy matches and watch them not knowing what's going to happen and just to see if they're going to win. And I think we're really getting that now, which is fantastic. Because they are now quite good, it sort of means that the days of rotating and sort of resting players or trying out some new combinations against Italy are kind of forgotten for now, which brings us to what England might do. And I just want to ask you both about Mario Tojo and how he's playing, and whether you wonder whether England might consider doing something different here. But personally, I don't think they will. And I think some of the overreactions to his performances have been a bit hysterical, given it's one game. But can you see, is there any way that England might look to change him or change other certain selections against Italy? It doesn't seem like they can afford to anymore, does it? Charlie, I'll come to you.
So what we heard in the build-up to this game, and what was kind of borne out, I think, by the selection of Chesson at lock, was that Cordy Laws was going to be at lock. I didn't see necessarily that was that felt quite punchy. But it looks like that was the way it was gonna go. So whether Laws coming back in and being considered as a lock with someone like Willis coming back into the back row too, whether that, it was interesting that Lewis Ludlam was used at the line out quite a lot as that auxiliary kind of third jumper. Maybe that could be the kind of the way Thurutoji going out of the side. I can't see it. I think I was just going to get, if I'll give an answer, then Charles can go back and I'll just go have a look at some stats from the game. But Maratoji conceded, always gets a lot of flak for conceding penalties. He conceded two penalties, which is the same as Oli Chesson. I think in games where England have a lot of possession, he isn't necessarily going to be as eye-catching just because his defensive disruption is kind of his super strength, to borrow a Borthwickism. Chesson was the more eye-catching carrier. There was, I think Itoji was involved in the clear out of the Scotland penalty at the end, where obviously Scotland were rewarded with a penalty, but could have gone either way. He's running the line out, I believe, which was a really, really good battle with Scotland. I just think maybe he's been a victim of these having these performances with huge highlight reel moments in them. It's not last year that his performance against Ireland was one of the best I've seen individually. I think maybe he's been a bit of a victim of his own kind of own standards in the past. He has had quiet games over the last year. I won't sugarcoat that. Premiership final, he was particularly quiet, I thought. But I think, you know, nobody is a kind of automatic choice in this England side, perhaps now, apart from Farrell with the captaincy and Genge. So I think they will consider it. If Laws is fit, but I would certainly give him the benefit of the doubt.
I completely agree. In fact, we're touching on it there, Charlie, but the only phrase that I've written down when I was sort of thinking about Maratoji is just a victim of his own success. Shamarthy burst on the scene and started playing at a level that was such a high level that we immediately all now have such high expectations, which we should have. But then if he has one quiet game, he didn't have a bad game on Saturday by any stretch of the imagination, but perhaps he was just slightly below that very world-class standard that we've expected of him. And yet in that Ireland game with the Six Nations last year, he was phenomenal. And you look at some of the Lions tests as well, he was phenomenal. And actually for Saracens this season, we shouldn't overlook the fact that he has been excellent more often than not. Yes, he was also very quiet in that Premiership final last year. But I'm going to slightly disagree with Charlie here. I think I just can't see any scenario whereby Steve Borthwick will drop Maratoji. And I think he's right to not to as well, especially if he's running the line out, which is obviously such a sort of secretive, probably the wrong word, but an unseen area where we're not even really privy to how that's run and how successful it's run. Only the coaching staff and the players are privy to that. And admittedly, England did lose three lineouts on their own throw on Saturday. But again, we don't know the machinations of that. We don't know who necessarily was at fault. Only the coaching staff will know that from the sort of books that they put in place and the system that they put in place.
So just kind of like back up that point on carrying. So Maratoji, 5 carries, and he's credited with 2 meters. So that's a lot of that is in heavy traffic, clearly. Whereas Chesson, more suited to those wide exchanges, and you got a big break. He got 2 big breaks, didn't he? One down the blind side off a potentially off Portfleet offload when he sniped down the blind side, and then another as Van Portfleet sniped again. So he ended up with 49 meters from 11 carries, which is obviously a hell of a lot more eye catching. But Itoji, 12 tackles with no miss. You had George with 10 carries, 10 tackles with no miss, and then anybody anywhere near that, and the only player anywhere near that was Ben Curry, who topped it with 13 tackles with 4 miss. So his output in there, and it'll be really interesting to see the rep numbers as well. I'm sure Itoji is very high on that Ringling, because he's often in those middle pods hitting those rucks. the unfussy stuff and the stuff that knits together the side, and I think he's in the thick of, and calling the line out, we know how tough that is because it clearly takes time to get good at it, because it's taken Maratoji a while to kind of settle into that job, and I think he's kind of admitted that himself. But one thing I would say, just in response to that point Charles has made there, is we can tell it's well, we can tell the line out's well called when they do what they did for Ellis Genge's try, when they get the penalty for the maul and then they peel away from the maul that Genge scores a couple of phases later. That just is really clever, and that's come from the strategy around the line out, which is what Itoji is in charge of on the field.
Yeah, I just think it's a bit mad, this whole notion of dropping. You've only got a couple of potentially world-class players in this England side. Tom Curry is currently injured. Mara is the other. I think if you said to most test coaches, if they had the option of selecting Itoji, that you might leave him out because of one game where he wasn't there, they spell one invest, I think they'd probably laugh you out of the room. To be honest, his 6 out of 10s and 7 out of 10s are often better than most locks, 9 out of 10. And so I think it's kind of crazy to even suggest that you would think to go elsewhere with him, because he is so vital in so much of what he does. He's honestly that he's going to be a huge part of this Borthwick side. And I think, I don't think there needs to be much more discussion about that. Let's jump to Cardiff in the first game of the Six Nations. We wondered if this might be a bit of a banana skin for Ireland to get to Cardiff facing Warren Gatland and a potentially rejuvenated Wales. And how wrong we were. That was pretty emphatic, wasn't it? Charles, I'll start with you. What did you like the most about Ireland's performance?
Caelan Doris. Oh, quickly becoming quickly becoming, you know, the best number 8 in the world. He's been phenomenal at 6 for Leinster, but this sort of play, a sort of dual number 8 role in the Leafs with Jack Conan. And then, my word, he just looks so at ease, so comfortable, so skillful, so intelligent, but also just so determined and so muscly and dynamic and quick thinking every single time he gets the ball. He's a real, real handbook at the minute. I mean, he's the fulcrum of this Ireland team. He's about the glue binding everything together. He is that for Ireland, especially with, you know, a slightly more unsettled midfield with regular inside centre Robbie Henshield being available and McCloskey coming in, who was excellent against Wales, by the way. But he is the sort of, he spearheaded the Irish charge at Cardiff, and Wales had no answer to it. The discrepancy, the difference between his performance and that of Toby Faletau, a British and Irish line opposite him, was stark. Real, real stark, and a sort of an embodiment of where the two teams are at, really. A complete microcosm.
It shouldn't have been lost. Look, in the scoreline, obviously, is emphatic. Ireland were way better. It shouldn't be lost that Ireland did have a bit of a wobble where the game management was really quite off in terms of some of their decision making and some of their tactical approach. And yet they still sort of rode that and came through it. I think what I like about this Irish side so much is just that, you know what you're getting. You're getting a highly efficient, consistent side whose error rate's pretty low, whose pack work ferociously, who, when you see them going through those pick and go phases and the short pop phases, sort of 5-10 meters up, just knowing eventually that they're going to score, they're going to find a way. You've got James Lowe being so smart with that intercept. They're just so well oiled at the moment. And that's why they were they were all about failures for the title, weren't they? And also why the game next weekend when France go to Dublin is just so exciting. But Charlie, if you going to put you on the spot, which way are you leaning for a winner in that game right now based on what you've seen last weekend?
Ireland, if only because I think if they finish top, they're probably going to be, I think even after the first weekend, I'm fairly certain that only one of my predicted 6 places in the table will be correct, and that'll be Ireland at the top. Now I can just see, just you always, I think their phase play is just so relentless that they always seem, and actually difficult to defend against largely, although that second half period that you're talking about, Colsey, them going 27-3 up at in half an hour, you felt that could have been anything at that point. And they just kind of, they had a lot of the ball, but Wales and managed to kind of just hold fast a little bit. So you wonder whether they kind of I think their phase play is good for a couple of tries a game. And I think it's that pack that's just, it's the dynamism of that pack. Guys like Dan Sheehan, now in the conversation for being one of the world's best hookers, having just burst on the scene. Doris, boring talking about Van der Flier now. Because he's just every game, he's 8, 9 out of 10. His carrying is just phenomenal. James Ryan, shout out to him, kind of persevered through a bit of a tricky patch in his career, maybe. Sort of became the fall guy for how Leinster and Ireland were getting out-muscled in games against more muscular teams, ironically, England being one of them, and South African opposition in URC, a big French opposition in the Champions Cup, now seems to have kind of settled into that role a little bit better. They're just really nicely balanced. And don't forget, they did that. That's a statement performance against Wales. They did that without Tadhg Furlong, without Robbie Henshaw, and with a late. I wondered whether they might, when Jameson Gibson-Park pulled out, wondered whether they might have gone with Craig Casey at nine, just to maintain that same profile of scrum half. They didn't. Conor Murray came in, still managed a really comfortable win that could have been heavier.
Yeah, I was going to make that point as well. I think that Gibson Park sort of withdrawn and how they managed that is quite a statement, actually, because he's been so important to Andy Farrell's side and how they sort of kept the momentum up and kept the tempo high with that phase play approach, and actually they barely missed a beat. I think that is really exciting for Ireland that they sort of overcame that weight quite comfortably and quite scary, really, for everybody else. And Charles, I need to ask you, who you think is going to win in Dublin? I assume, given you're travelling everywhere, that you're going to be there. It's just my hunch, is that right?
I am there. I think after yesterday, many people might think that Ireland will win comfortably. I'm not sure that will be the case. I do think there will be a French response after yesterday. They will not be as undisciplined, and they won't be as cold as they were in Rome yesterday. But I do think Ireland at home, with how well they won last weekend and how well they've been playing recently and how cohesive that team is and how well they know each other, they'll just about prevail.
Yeah, kind of wait for it. Game of the tournament. I reckon Ireland will win it as well, and it can't come soon enough. Right, let's just wrap up with a couple of quick questions to finish. We'll be back in a sec. Okay, just to finish up, we've got a few more questions from readers that we want to go through before we leave you until next week. And one from Manor Rugby, which I had about Twickenham. And then this was a point that I saw was picked up on, I think, a rugby cast social media with a fan sort of going off about Twickenham just has no atmosphere and no noise. And the question was, Twickenham is no longer a fortress, and while the team have to win and play better, how are the RFU addressing the issue of the distinct lack of atmosphere? Should they cut the corporate tickets and price of normal ones to appeal to a younger demographic? Which I think is actually quite an interesting point. And both of you, what was the atmosphere like on Saturday? Charles, if I start with you.
I thought the atmosphere was very good, actually. I thought the atmosphere was very good, and I thought it was noticeably improved from the autumn. I think you could write an essay on potentially the RFU's ticketing strategy, who should be getting those tickets, are there too many corporate guests, are there enough sort of day-to-day rugby fans and people who contribute at community level going to those matches? That's a different story. The RFU are obviously trying to find the balance between making sure that those people are catered for, but also getting much needed revenue on the back of the COVID-19 pandemic, where they didn't host a game. But also a slightly sort of left field point was that I thought the atmosphere was improved, and I spoke to people who didn't enjoy that match. And it wasn't a sort of classic in terms of the skills and other than the tries. I meant to say that the game as a whole was necessarily a classic in terms of the skill level on show. There was a lot of kicking, which people often get frustrated with, but noticeably across seven tries, there was no use of the TMO. And I wonder if sort of subconsciously that has also added to the spectacle there, where if we'd have had exactly the same game played out again with each try chip with the TMO, I wonder if people would have been coming away thinking that was a lesser spectacle. Shall we say it was a great match, and I thought the atmosphere was brilliant, and the tries were outstanding. but there was a lot of kicking. There was a lot of stop-starts. The scrum was a bit of a mess in the first half. And I just feel if people, because of the lack of TMO usage, whether that's been sort of quite quickly forgotten.
Charlie, what did you make of it?
I think that's a really, really, really good point from Charles, because the first quarter, or near the first quarter, when did Scotland, what minute did Scotland score it? Before that, it had been pretty kind of, dominated by kicking exchanges, and you think, was it going to be one of those turgid, edgy ones? And then it kind of exploded from there, but there were scrum problems throughout. And Charles is spot on there. You came away thinking that was just almost a breezy, entertaining game. That was good fun. Been asked about somebody else mentioned the atmosphere to me this morning, saying it sounded more corporate than usual from somebody that was there. I didn't pick up on that, and I don't know whether that's me just being blinkered to what I was doing, but I'm watching the game and having the ref mic on, and I didn't pick up on that at all. But the certainly seemed more positive. Quite enjoyed the Steve Borthwick's quote being played out over a montage of England playing like WWE, which is quite interesting.
Steve Borthwick's brand.
Certainly. Yeah,
it was while the players were on the field. It was just before kickoff.
It was crazy.
I wasn't there. Was it sort of Kevin Keegan-esque? Like they're gonna have to go there and get a result. What was it?
It was just we're gonna show fight. We're gonna be a team to be proud of, that sort of thing. But I'm all in if I'm an England fan. Getting ready to watch that. No, I have to say I didn't pick up on it being a mooted atmosphere at all. I've seen that video on Twitter though.
It's mainly funny for the bloke going, I can't take my dad anywhere. Sorry, he's obviously not his dad. Just a very good gag. Maybe that's something to watch over the course of the tournament. I just wanted to, I also had a message from on a different matter from the group of colorblind awareness about Wales v Ireland, and how Wales v Ireland, if you're colorblind, is just an absolute nightmare because you just cannot make out what's going on with the red and green. And how this does affect quite a lot of people, like 1 in 12 men, 1 in 200 women. I do wonder if, I know World Rugby have sort of looked at this, and actually Mike Blair, who coaches in Edinburgh, he's spoken out about this before. I do wonder if there is some way to address it. I don't know what that is. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I thought it was worth referencing because it does affect a lot of people.
What are their respective alternate strips? Wales black still and Ireland white?
I don't know if black and white might be no better. I'm not sure. I'm not colorblind myself, but it would be great if the colorblind awareness group let us know what their ideal sort of color blend would be for Wales Islanders. Then we could feed that back, of course.
I was just saying, real treat seeing Italy's alternate strip. That was gorgeous.
A beauty. An absolute peach.
That was very nice. Well, that's a nice positive note to end the podcast off. Let's leave it there. Right, that's it for today. A massive thank you to Charlie and Charles, as always. And the three of us are going to be back next week after the latest round of Six Nations action. Please keep your eye on the website for tons of content from the likes of Will Greenwood, Brian Moore, Gavin Mayers, and all of us as we build up to another weekend of matches. And also, please hit that subscribe button and let your friends know what a lovely time you've had listening to us every Monday. Until next week, see you then. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.